I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Alan Abel joins me now. The veteran journalist has a new book out, The Short Life of Huey McLune, a true story of baseball, magic, and murder. The book begins with McLune's murder. It is 1928 and he's 26 years old, but what a remarkable life. After getting injured by falling off a seesaw as a child, he would never grow more than 50 inches tall. As a younger person, he was bat boy and mascot of Connie Mack's Philadelphia Athletics. Players would rub his hump for luck. They didn't do that well in the three seasons McLune was part of the club. In fact, they were in last place each season. But Huey became a local celebrity. Mr. Abel pieces together McLune's life and times. We get a marvelous sense of what Philadelphia was like 100 years ago, as well as what was happening in the wider world. There was a world war, an epidemic, as well as prohibition. Baseball was a big deal then, something that various segments of society followed and attended at the famed Shibe Park. After baseball, McLune became a boxing manager and promoter. He owned his own speakeasy while serving as a secret agent for the city's crime-busting director of public safety. However, it all comes to an end with Huey caught in the crossfire outside his tavern. More than 15,000 citizens lined up to see his body. Alan Abel is a longtime journalist in Canada who was Beijing bureau chief for the Globe and Mail, and more recently the White House correspondent for McLean's. He was on television for many years at the CBC as well as HBO and Discovery, hosting documentaries. He's won 6 national magazine awards for his sports writing and foreign reporting. I was in high school when I read his memoir, Flatbush Odyssey, A Journey Through the Heart of Brooklyn. It remains one of the more captivating and enjoyable books I've read, as is this new one, which is published by Sutherland House. He joined me from Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago tomorrow. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Alan Abel. Mr. Abel, good morning.
Hello there.
Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be asked.
The thing that fascinated me as I started reading The Short Life of Huey McLune was just how big baseball was 100 or so years ago. It really was such a part of people's lives then, I guess. I mean, is that a correct assumption on my part?
Well, I think it's still part of people's lives now. It's been part of hundreds of millions of people's lives for 150 years, but in a civic way, and the idea of a city's identification. Well, there was no NBA, there was no NFL, there was organized professional hockey in its very infancy, but baseball had grown with the cities themselves from the Elysian Fields, as the first ballpark was called in New Jersey in the 1850s, to the brick and mortar stadiums that fit a perfect city block in virtually every city there was. It just was part of the civic experience, and there was no other. I don't think there was anything else in those days that had a city's name on it. That there was a group of men at that time who wore the word Philadelphia or Detroit or Chicago across their chest. There were the university teams. College mm-hmm. football was a bit older, mm-hmm. but not in the same way. And in college was seen, I think, as so elite that the common person, the common worker who had 25 cents could see his city fought for and defended. And seeing your tribe or your clan fought for, defended, is a very basic human thing that goes back, I guess, hundreds of thousands of generations.
And when you say that it was the age of magic, what do you mean by that?
Well, baseball is spectacularly difficult to perform at well. Ted Williams, a great hitter in the 1940s and 50s, said that hitting a round ball with a round bat squarely is the hardest feat in sports. And I'm not sure that's harder than a slap shot or harder than riding a thoroughbred. Uh-huh. But it is spectacularly difficult, and anyone who succeeds one time out of three is in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, yeah.
So hitters, batters faced with this pitcher throwing curveballs with spit on it, always look for some sort of edge. And there were lucky coins, and there were lucky animals, and the same way that there's still a Navy goat and an Army mule or a white charger that goes up and down the sideline at a Calgary Stampeders game. There's always been that animal totem, I guess would be the right word.
Uh-huh.
And then in the 1880s, there was a French operetta called La Mascotte. And La Mascotte was the story of a very attractive turkey herder somewhere in Provence who was congenitally magical and lucky. And this word had never been in the language before. When that play came to New York in 1881 or 1882, it introduced the whole spectacularly new idea that a lucky charm could actually be a person and vice versa. So teams began to cast about for human lucky charms, and the human association with the diminutive, with Quasimodo or Rigoletto or Tom Thumb, or the Munchkins, I guess, for that matter, goes back a lot further than baseball. So there became this sort of triple confluence of baseball players searching for anything that would be lucky, for this relationship with, the tiny, the deformed, the pitiable in some way, and then this operetta, La Mascotte, gave a name and a personage to the personification of luck. So baseball players and boxers also, which is a big part of poor McClune's story. Boxers started walking into the ring with a hunchback on their shoulders. And so this trend, once a team succeeded with a tiny, tiny person or a boy who supposedly was born with a full beard or a mouthful of teeth, they substituted the four-legged chickens and the goose that was trained to walk up and quack on home plate. So it's a complicated story of why hunchbacks in baseball, but that it was the age of magic is indisputable. And a century ago, right up until the 1930s, most major league teams, many or most, had a disabled child as their bat boy and lucky charm. And that's truth. It's all 100% true.
It really happened. It really is a different era, and a lot of it would not be, say, acceptable today. It's so fascinating to read, especially McClune's story. He was not the first, was he, for the Athletics, right?
No, what had happened with the Athletics, and it takes a minute to explain this.
Yeah.
About 1910, there was a boy who had fallen off a wagon named Louis Van Zelst, the son of Dutch immigrants. And he'd been adopted by the University of Pennsylvania. He could barely walk. He couldn't stand or even sit without pain. He was suffered a terrible spinal injury. And, of course, there was neither the money to treat it nor the science to treat it in those days. And Van Zelst got the courage to go up to the A's stadium one day and asked to go in to the park, and they let him in. And the players saw him, this hunched-over little figure, but he never stopped smiling. And the players took a liking to him, and the great Connie Mack, who was the manager, the owner of the Philadelphia Athletics for more than 55 years, and was still managing into his 90s, said, "How'd you like to tend the bats for us today?" And ball players have always been superstitious about the physical wood that they swing, and that somehow it is invested at the factory with a certain number of hits in it, and that the jinx, the hoodoo, the Jonah, can somehow make those hits fall out of the wood so you can't succeed at the bat. So little Lewis tends the bats, making sure none of them cross each other. And the A's win, and they say, "How'd you like to come back the next day?" And he comes back and comes back. The players simply revere him. They adore him. He is a spirit of the newspapers say that in the body of a martyr was placed the soul of a saint. That's not something you hear about B.J. Birdie, the Blue Jays mascot. And so with Van Zelst as their bat boy and mascot, they win 4 American League championships and 3 World Series in 5 years. So whether Mac, who's a devout Catholic, believes in the superstition or not, whether the players deep down in their hearts really think that this boy, he squats by home plate and he shouts out, "Rub my hump, better rub my hump this time." And he submits to it. And someone asked me the other day, what about advocates for the rights of the disabled? I don't think there were many advocates for the rights of the disabled in Philadelphia in 1910. So they win with Van Zelst, and then quite pitiably, he dies at the age of 19. Just before the 1915 season, the A's are too shattered to bring in another child mascot, and they finish last.
Yeah.
The same year, the crosstown rivals, the Philadelphia Phillies, adopt their own hunchback, and they win their only championship for 50 years. So So by 1916, the Athletics again are in last place. This little boy whose grandmother lives across the street from the stadium, just about to turn 14, weighs 58 pounds, and he tries to go up to Connie Mack's office to replicate the success of little Louis Van Zelst, and he's too weak to open the door. But again, the players take a liking to him. They adopt him and say, "Hey, Connie, we found another hunchback, and we keep him." In the way that a child would say, "I found a stray puppy, can I keep him?"
Yeah, yeah.
So there is a precedent for McClune. No one ever said that he had the soul of a saint. He was a wise-ass, smart-talking, umpire-heckling street kid who really spent his life searching for the father that he didn't have. His own father had died of tuberculosis when he was four, and he was always in the company of famous men, and the most famous man of all was Connie Mack. The great heroes of the time were the great Philadelphia Athletics, and so he, in a perverse way, I guess, became the luckiest boy in the city by first being the unluckiest boy in the city who broke his back falling off the seesaw when he was three. And that act of the injury somehow, and all these other mascots had suffered terrible injuries, and somehow their own suffering was transmuted into luck or good fortune. And it seems strange, and it seems perverse, and it seems illogical, and it seems cruel, but that is absolute reality. Absolute reality.
So the difference
from the team time.
Yeah. So the difference between say previous mascots and then McClune. You mentioned this a moment ago that he was he was heckling and sort of he was not an endearing sort of character. The story though about going to Mack's office, because you quote McClune in your book. Talking to Elijah Way, for example, that wasn't true, was it?
It's true in the sense that that's how it was reported. I wasn't at Shive Park on July 11th, 1916. I go back to the Brooklyn Dodgers, but not to 1916. But there certainly was an idea that a team without a hunchback was a team with less chance of success. But McClune was, if you had to visualize him, think of the Lollipop Guild of the Munchkins who greets Dorothy when she lands in Oz. Those kind of wisecracking kids, or the Bowery Boys, or the Little Rascals. But no one ever called him a saint. He was not a sainted little child. I don't think he ever was seen. He certainly was irreverent, and I don't think he was revered. But I guess he was just a snappy little guy to be around, to have around. But I don't think they saw him as numinous in any way. I don't think he was possessed with a saintly beneficence in the way that they certainly saw in Van Zelst.
Now this injury, he fell off a seesaw, as you said earlier. Would this be something that could have been corrected today?
Hard to say, because so little was reported on it at the time. There was a long feature story in the Inquirer about 1901, which would have been 4 years before Huey fell off the seesaw, about a misfortunate little boy who had a similar injury, and they used Hippocratic techniques to try to stretch out his back. And Hippocrates had written in, I think, the 5th century B.C. about you put a hat of some kind on the patient and have him lie down, and then you attach a weight to the hat. So through a system of pulleys, it stretches the body. I doubt that was a pleasant treatment to undergo.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think that, from that article at least, it didn't seem that medical science had succeeded any more greatly in the correction of kyphosis by 1906 or so, 7, than it had in 400 B.C. And it's unlikely that Huey's mother, widowed, sainted mother, who was already remarried, but she put in her marriage form 15 years later, she was both a widow and had never been married before, which is a unique daily double.
Yeah.
But it's unlikely that anything could have been done for him. There was an orthopedic hospital for children in Philadelphia. There's no record there that a kid named McClune was ever treated there.
How did
could it be corrected now? I hope so.
Yeah.
I sure hope so.
Yeah. How did Ewan McLuhan, how did he view his difference? I mean, there's an episode later in his life, near the end of his life, where it does play a part in terms of how he feels about it, or how he thinks other people feel about it. But until then, I mean, he obviously uses his difference to sort of his advantage in terms of getting this job with the Athletics.
I think he struts it.
Yeah,
I think he struts it proudly.
Does he make peace with it, though?
I guess so. There is no evidence of his internal life. This is not someone who left a diary or who left troves of letters or who wrote an autobiography. This is a kid about whom very little is known, which obviously makes the biographer's task awfully difficult, harder than hitting a round ball with a round bat. To try to guesstimate his inner feelings about his disability, it would seem to me that he strutted it. He strutted with boxers. He certainly didn't hide it. He's the one who carries the round card at the Dempsey-Tunney World Heavyweight Championship boxing match with 130,000 people in the stands screaming. He's right at ring center. He's not hiding in a dark room. And this was a time when many cities had what were called ugly laws that prohibited deformed people, disabled people, unsightly in the eyes of others, from even being on the public street. So he sure didn't hide it. And I think that the headline of one of the stories about Van Zelst was most envied boy in the country. I think Huey was darn proud of being paid to hang around the great heroes. One of his successors in New York, Babe Ruth, had a personal hunchback named Eddie Bennett, who was with the Yankees for a dozen years. And every home run Babe Ruth hit, he shook Eddie Bennett's hand first, played catch with him before every game, purposely throwing the ball just too high for Eddie to reach. But there was a profile in the New Yorker of Eddie Bennett, and the consensus was, why is this guy get to be paid to hang around with Babe Ruth and Luke Gehrig and the Yankees when the rest of us have to buy a ticket? So I think that the being a bat boy, being with those guys down on the field, was an enviable position. And I think Huey strutted it. I don't think until the climax of his life, or what leads to the end of his life, apparently. Until then, I don't think he was ashamed of it at all, or he wouldn't be out parading before 130,000 people.
Indeed. Life of his and your book takes place at such a fascinating time. I mean, there's so many things happening in the wider world that sort of intersect with what's happening, be that the Spanish flu or the Great War. Someone you talk about in the book is Billy Sunday, and I've always found evangelists fascinating, and it's hard to say comprehend just how big Sunday was at the time. And I'd forgotten until I read your book that he had played baseball with Connie Mack.
He had a better than average major league career. He was an outfielder with the Phillies and some other teams. And Sunday, whose real name was William Sunday, he was apparently the most dynamic, the most flamboyant of these public temperance. He jumped on the stage. He leapt onto the podium. He waved his fist. He ran around the arena. And he spoke in that way, they said, to more people in person than anyone else in human history. He was fantastically popular. And, of course, in the end, he achieved prohibition, which then achieved spectacular failure in places like Philadelphia. But Sunday had been a ball player. There were a lot of ball players who spoke for temperance. There were a lot who were hammered every night, I'm sure, after the game. Game's over at 4 o'clock. You're in a strange city, and the TV hasn't been invented yet. There's not much else to do.
Yeah.
But Sunday was obviously a compelling speaker. He was the Garth Brooks of the temperance circuit. He was just, or the Al Jolson in those years. He was a great performer, obviously a great natural performer. and he knew the power of baseball to influence the masses. And so several of Mack's ball players would be at Sunday's lectures when he was in Philadelphia, and they carried that same gospel themselves, and many of them preached temperance.
Mack himself was a teetotaler, wasn't he?
He professed to be a teetotaler. He let his players have a beer in the clubhouse, and there was no point to force temperance on others. He wrote in his autobiography called My 66 Years in Professional Baseball, which is a long time, that he had promised his dear sainted mother back in Massachusetts when he went away to play the evil game of baseball with all those evil Irishmen in the 1880s that he would never touch a drop. And there's an anecdote about him that every day when he'd come home from the stadium, that his wife would pour him a glass of whiskey, because just he probably could have used it to calm down. Yeah. And every day he would pour it down the sink. He certainly professed to be a teetotaler. There's no evidence that he ever violated that pledge to his mom.
Yeah. I mentioned the Spanish flu, and it's fascinating to read your book, and sort of as I did in the last year, especially considering the last year we've all endured. What was it like? I mean, I guess you wrote this before.
Yeah, COVID, it was written before COVID.
So when you look at that era as you did, and what an effect it had on Philadelphia, especially, well, it had an effect throughout the United States. But in this book, you write about Philadelphia specifically. We've all been drawing parallels to our own recent experience with it. Do you have a sense of where we're headed?
Well, we're at the point where there's an article quoted in the book about how the city is bracing for the bars to open again, and the police were being assigned to the saloons, ready for the big reopening. The thing about the Spanish flu seems to be that it took the healthiest people, and they died on the same day. A cough in the morning, a sore throat, and then sputum, and then collapse, and then turning blue, and then death on the same day. But the thing about Philadelphia was that they hosted a Liberty Bond parade. This is during the First World War. There was the parallel that we've read about recently, that St. Louis canceled its parade. Philadelphia went ahead with it. Something like 200,000 people stood shoulder to shoulder along Broad Street, and it killed thousands of them. So obviously there was less knowledge. Was there a Fauci then? Yeah, there was a guy named Dr. Wilmer Krusen, the same one who had said that people who have a propensity toward deformity should abstain from having children. He said everything but put them on an ice floe and push them out to sea. So there were public health officials. There were warnings. There certainly were drives to wear a mask. All those parallels are accurate. But the rapidity of the death of healthy people was very different from our recent experience of the nursing homes.
Right.
In that way, it was the opposite of that.
Right.
And that must be even more frightening.
Indeed. Alan, what happens to McLuhan as he gets older after baseball? I mean, he obviously loves the limelight, and so he ends up in the company of other powerful men or colorful men in boxing. Is that right?
Well, boxing and hunchbacks had the same association as with baseball. McLuhan, when he leaves the Athletics after they finish with the three worst records in the history of baseball, the 3 years he's there, so you can't quite say he was a lucky charm.
Right.
He drifts into promoting amateur and semi-pro sports events. He drifts then into boxing, which is the other main spectator sport of the era. And just as he goes into boxing, comes prohibition, and you have this association, this crossroads of boxing, which has never been on the upper side of the up and up, and the bootleggers, who assume an awful lot of power in a city that Philadelphia embraced prohibition the way Donald Trump would embrace Rosie O'Donnell. So, in fact, it was said there were more bars in Philly during prohibition than there are in Philly now. So boxing becomes the purview of the bootleggers. Huey's part of boxing. He becomes a professional manager. He's not just seen then as just a, a lucky munchkin. He's actually managing fighters, making matches. So he's part of the boxing world. And the boxing world is the bootlegger's world. And at the same time, he has been sort of semi-adopted by a very flamboyant magistrate in Philadelphia who's known as the dancing judge. So Huey is the dancing judge's clerk. The dancing judge prosecutes bootleggers at the same time that he is frequenting all their establishments.
Yeah.
So Huey goes to these lavish, booze-soaked parties at the same time he's trying to hand subpoenas to society people in Philly for carrying a bottle of gin in their fur coat. So he's playing both sides of Prohibition. He seems to be having an absolutely grand time of it. He attends trials. He throws out wisecracks from the stands. And then comes the denouement, which you can decide if you want me to reveal or not.
I want to go back to that thing that I mentioned a moment ago about how he viewed his disability, because to this day we don't really know what happened or who caused his death. We can get a sense of, you know, we can make up our own minds as we read your book, but this idea of him being insulted by a woman because of his disability.
That's what it seems to be.
Yeah.
What can you do? But when there are 10 daily newspapers, it's sort of do a Venn diagram. What do they all agree on?
Right.
And what they seem to agree on is that Huey frequented a certain house of pleasure that was also popular with Babe Ruth and other celebrities, and that he attempted at some point to make a pass at a young woman who was called, quote, one of the inmates of that establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And that apparently she made fun of him, of his stature, made fun of the hump between his shoulders. And he slapped her, or punched her, or went to her place and trashed her furniture. And went back to his speakeasy and some of his associates on the left field side of legality said, you're not going to stand for that, are you? You're not going to let a dame make fun of you.
Right.
So he didn't let the dame make fun of him, and apparently, again, the consensus of the reporting at the time was that that, quote, dame or that mall was friendly with some of the men who played on one of the other teams on the Bootleggers League, and they took care of him.
Mm.
That was the end of the short life of Huey McClune, but it seems probable that it was his attempt to break through that wall that the world saw him only as a freak or as a hunchback or as a celebrity munchkin. And he's 26 at that point, and one would guess he has his own desires and his own dreams, and when you get mocked, that's a pretty hurtful thing.
Yeah,
and that seems to be what led to his demise. But again, I go back a long way, but I wasn't in that brothel in 1926. Poor little Huey.
Yeah, it's a brutal death, and what sort of funeral was it?
Well, 15,000 people lined up to see his body. That's a pretty good crowd for a major league ball game. Everybody knew him in Philadelphia. There was a chartered train that brought people from Broadway. The funeral was on a Monday, and so Broadway was dark. And Broadway came. There's nothing that I found anywhere in the research that associates him with Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
But yet he was known there, too. 15,000 people in the side street off Broad Street in South Philadelphia. His coffin is carried by judges and baseball figures. His funeral is paid for by Mickey Duffy, who's one of the Paramount gangsters of the age, the subject of the Boardwalk Empire TV series.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the expenses, a check for $2,500 is given to his poor, grieving, wailing, screaming mother by Boo Boo Hoff, who is the Al Capone of the East Coast. So it is a carnival of the underworld with police squad cars, bulletproof hearse, expecting retaliation at any moment. It becomes this carnival of the underworld plus professional sports plus judges. The mayor is there, and this is a kid who hung out with Babe Ruth and Al Capone. And that's it's a pretty special life when you really have nothing special about you except your back didn't work.
It's such an unbelievable story that if you'd written this as a novel, I'm sure an editor would have said, no, this is too improbable. Do you remember the first time you came across Huey McClune?
Well, I had worked with an editor at CBC when I was at the Journal in the documentary unit, who was from Cleveland, Bob Schroeder, and he knew about baseball's Age of Magic, and he knew about Van Zelst. And he eventually worked on a book and wrote a book about Van Zelst and some of the other mascots around 1911. And I was intrigued about Van Zelst. I know something about baseball history, having lived through about half of it. Mm-hmm. And there was this mention that, well, what happened after Van Zelst died? Did they get another hunchback? Yeah, they did. And a man in the Philly suburbs has been researching Prohibition and bootlegging in Philadelphia for most of his lifetime, mailed me about a 2-inch thick packet of clippings, and the very top one was, Hugh McClune murdered, two other men shot, and the subhead, hunchback mascot murdered with sawed-off guns. And you got to look at that. You got to take a double take.
Yeah.
Hunchback mascot murdered with sawed-off guns. This is page one of the Philadelphia Bulletin.
Yeah.
On August 9th, 1928. You start with the word hunchback. Well, that connotes something. Mascot, we know what the mascot is. Murdered, that's not a good thing.
Yeah.
And then the sawed-off guns denotes something even more sinister. And that's a pretty intriguing, for any reporter. I've been a reporter since 1972. But for any reporter, hunchback mascot murdered by sawed-off guns. Then you learn the probable suspect was a career criminal named Shorty Feldman. And there you go. If you don't want to dig into that.
Yeah, it's like Runyon had written this, you know?
Well, Runyon wouldn't have had to make this up.
Yeah.
Runyon covered the Philadelphia A's.
Yeah.
What
was it like to go back and read these clippings and do the research that you did? Because you had to fill in a lot of blanks here.
It's almost all blank.
Yeah.
It's almost all blank. But it is, it's fun because the sports writing then, just to start with the sports writing, was as flamboyant, as extravagant, as exuberant as you possibly could imagine. It was competitive. And every slang phrase of baseball, every slang phrase of boxing was well entrenched by the 1910s. You could pick up a game story of the Red Sox against the Athletics in 1906, and it wouldn't read that differently from a game story in 2021. All the elements were there. The personalities were made larger than life. They were heroes. They were champions. And it was, I guess in an existential sense, as irrelevant to human life now then as it is now. But it certainly was part of the urban experience. And it was important to people, and they thronged to the newsboys. They set up gigantic electronic scoreboards during the championship games where massive crowds would gather outside the newspaper offices as each pitch was relayed by telegraph, and they'd put a number up on a scoreboard. It was vitally important. And obviously it was important to newspaper circulation. They devoted an awful lot of attention. The New York Times ran 13 pages on that Dempsey-Tunney fight that I mentioned, where Huey was ring center. It was quite a time, and it was obviously rewarding to be a newspaper man at that time. It was exciting. It was sensational. And it's all real. Yeah. It all really happened, which is the best part of it.
If you'll indulge me for a minute, or for a few minutes, if you will, about a previous book that you've written that I read in high school, and I just really loved, Flatbush Odyssey. I picked it up recently. I haven't read it in probably about 15 years or so, and I just leafed through it, and there were parts in the book that I remember as if I'd read it 3 days ago. And then there were other parts that I forgot, and so now I'm going to go back in the next couple of weeks and sit with it again. What did your mother think of the book when it came out? I know it came out to great reviews. What did she make of it?
Well, just to summarize it, it's the story of the main street of Brooklyn, New York, where my mother lived for 61 years in the same. information of any place in history. But I portray her in the book. She said to me one again, she said, "Is that me?" I portrayed her as a chain-smoking, wise-cracking, coughing, apocalyptically coughing old hag. She said, "Is that me?" I said, "Well, I'm not saying that's you, but that's how I've chosen to portray you." She said, "Maybe I shouldn't smoke anymore." And she quit that day after 50 years.
Wow.
She gained a lot of weight, but she stopped smoking.
Yeah.
So the idea that this woman who really had never even worked outside the home from an era when just most women didn't, to suddenly be the cynosure of this book was pretty extraordinary to her. It really, it rocked her world. I'm glad that I was able to rock her world. But not many Yiddish mamas of her vintage in Brooklyn, sitting in a one-room apartment for 61 years, achieved that kind of 15 seconds of fame, I guess. But if you want to talk, if you want to speak favorably of the book, take your time. There's no hurry.
It's such an enjoyable book, and it's it. I read it at an impressionable age, where the only conception I had of New York, and I loved it even before I'd even gone there, because I hadn't gone there until very recently, was Manhattan. And so this was a way to get me outside of that and into Brooklyn especially. You grew up there. It's a very different place today, even the Brooklyn that you write about in Flatbush Odyssey 30 years ago or so. It's very different than it is now. Did you get to go
there,
back?
There were no artisan bagels when I grew up there.
did you get to go back? And if you do, does it feel familiar at all?
You know, my sister's still in Brooklyn, not in the same neighborhood, but down in a little corner as far from hipster Brooklyn as you can get, down by the Verrazano Bridge, down in Saturday Night Fever, part of Brooklyn. And not Williamsburg and Park Slope, and not the artisan bagel, hot wax yoga kind of part of Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And where she is, there's still some pockets of what I grew up with, which I would call the Brooklyn of the, "Hey, how you doing?" That Brooklyn.
Yeah.
There's a bit of it still there. But it's mostly gone. And maybe it should be gone, but it's mostly gone. Obviously, it's gone demographically. We're all at least 110 years old. Those of us who remember those years. And physically, the real estate has changed. It's once Manhattan just became out of reach for most young working people, the Brooklyn Renaissance coincided with Giuliani's crackdown on subway crime. With the approval of his tactics or not, it made the subways appear safer, feel safer. And that's what created the new Brooklyn, the hipster Brooklyn. The places now are called after Brooklyn. There's a Brooklyn Cafe around here.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But anyway, that was the Brooklyn I grew up in. I grew up in the Danny Kaye, Three Stooges, Barbra Streisand Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And that is long gone now.
Was Flatbush Odyssey your first book?
There was a collection of my Globe and Mail sports columns that was published sometime in the mid-19th century. But by then I was gone to the China Bureau. I did a day-by-day of a CBC documentary assignment to Kuwait and Iran at the end of the Gulf War when the oil wells were set on fire. So there was a day-by-day thing that was published. That's 30 years ago.
Yeah.
1991.
Yeah. And so when this book came out, in terms of its success, I mean, it sold well and got good notices. What did it mean for you as a writer? Did you think that you'd go on to write other books, say?
Well, I thought when I had written the book about Iran and Kuwait, and it was very, very, very well received in Canada anyway, where I was somewhat well known from CBC.
Uh-huh.
I thought, if I ever go through this ordeal, I mean, if you divide dollars by hours, you're not going to write books anyway.
Sure.
If I ever go through this again, I'm going to be a New Yorker who writes a book about New York in New York. Like, if I have any talent at this at all, and I'm certainly not claiming that I do, if I have any ability at this, let's go right into the belly here and write about New York in New York. And I have been, I always joke that I've been to 150 countries on other people's money. Mm-hmm. But I've been down so many other main streets and so many other cities. I remember going down Flatbush Avenue, which extends from the Manhattan Bridge all the way down to the swamps and wasteland of the Tidewater on the Atlantic shore. Boy, this street's as interesting as any street I've ever been on in Calcutta or Cairo or any place else. I thought, okay, let's do this. And I got hundreds and hundreds of letters from ex-Brooklynites who waxed nostalgic about what I've been writing about. But in terms of it being hailed as a literary masterpiece, of course not, because I'm no literary master. But I didn't see any reason. It certainly didn't create me as the great chronicler. And I didn't expect it to, because by then I think the historical society people were so entrenched in New York that they saw me as a Canadian, which is a delicious irony.
But I have to say that in reading The Short Life of Hugh McLuhan, I don't know if it was the influence of the reading that you did from the era. It just reads so entertainingly fine that it's a difficult book to put down.
That's good, because my others are difficult books to pick up. I always guarantee, if someone always says, yeah, I bought your book, I say, well, you'll either have a nice read or a good night's sleep.
But this is such an entertaining book. It must have been fun to do the research and to write it. Was it fun to write?
I don't know. I don't want to go too far out on a limb, but I've probably written more words for money than any other Canadian journalist who's living. That may well be true after 50 years. So the act of writing, I think for a journalist, I don't want to get too high-hatted here. To me, it's not the act of writing, it's the act of getting it right. I've never had writer's block. I've never stared at a blank keyboard. I don't drink coffee. I've never smoked. And I've never been afflicted with that sort of angst that other people I know have been. Mm-hmm. So the actual typing, I consider what I've done typing, not writing, but the actual typing is, it flows pretty easily. But the fear or the trepidation that I might get something wrong is very powerful. So that's the motivation. As for somebody asked for 25,000 words here, I'll give you 25,000 words. You want 40,000, I'll give you 40,000. And that's not to be glib about it, but when you've done something for 5 decades, you should know how to do it by now. So is it fun to write about McLuhan? Sure. But the most important thing is getting it right. This is nonfiction. There's not one sentence in all those pages that I made up. So I think if it comes from anywhere, that's where the pride comes from. That I didn't make this up. This really happened. No profession to this being a Nobel Prize for Literature, but gee, he's an awfully amazing character.
He is, yeah. We read you regularly in McLean's. Are you still working for them?
No, haven't been with McLean's since last summer. I think they aren't doing any foreign coverage anymore, or any kind of regular coverage outside Canada.
What was it like to work in the White House?
Well, I was there for 12 years. What was it like? You know, when I started television, they said, there's only 3 questions you can ask. How do you feel? Describe your emotions, and what's it like? It is not like, well, I want to say the Obama White House and the Trump White House at my level weren't that different. You sit in the briefing room. They'd never call on me to ask a question. And you observe what's going on. When I was sent by the Globe and Mail to China, just out of the sports column in 1983, the managing editor said, just paint the color of the sky, which I said was easy because it's so polluted, it's just gray.
Yeah.
But it was similar. I described what was going on. I tried to go down the middle. I got comments about the Trump coverage that I clearly was a libtard, I guess is the word they use. Typical lefty libtard. And I got comments that said, you're in Trump's pocket. So that's when I figured I was hitting the ball right down the middle. Yeah. I'm not political. not politicized, not ever aspire to be controversial. I'm not opinionated. I'm not a pundit. I'm a reporter. And at least when I began, there was a difference. I didn't like the colleagues in the press corps who seemed to be there just so they could write a book, that front row at the Trump show kind of bravado. But I understand there's money to be made. We're all doing this. We write for money. And I could see why they would do that. I didn't like the antagonistic back and forth in either administration with the press and the spokespeople, because I knew that behind the back they were going out for drinks together, despite despite the daily broadcast from the briefing room. So in a way, I don't think I ever lost my awe and wonder of actually being in the White House or in the Capitol building. I was front row at the first impeachment, front row at all those hearings, front row at Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and those sort of things, and that was extremely exhilarating. And I think more exhilarating, I would say that I don't know who else covered two great fights of the last century, Ali Frazier and Trump Clinton. But I think at the end of the day, to be a sports journalist, you have to suspend your disbelief. You have to really feel that these endeavors matter, that victory is glorious and defeat is painful, because certainly the players do, and the fans do. And to cover it, you have to feel like I'm stepping into an important world here, and what happens tonight in this Oilers-Flames game matters. I think many sports writers find that harder to do, but I never found it hard to say this hearing for Justice Kavanaugh matters, because it does matter. And that's the difference between the two.
Do you think sports, your work in sports early in your career, I guess that it seems like covering politics later and sort of it makes it a natural, I suppose. I mean, they all say that all the good sports writers become good political writers or good writers to begin with. I guess it just makes sense, doesn't it, to make that progression?
Well, in my case, I came out of college with a degree in astrophysics, but I had managed and broadcast for the hockey team. And so I knew the local sports writers, and I begged for and got a job at $48 a week taking high school scores over the phone. No one ever sensed to me, and I didn't sense to myself then that it was going to be a career behind a keyboard. But sports is so easy to do. Anyone can write sports, because at the most basic, it's just what happened at the game. Oh, Willie Mays hit a home run and the Giants won 3-2. Nothing's easier than that. But sports allows you to just have so much fun with it. And when I came to Toronto in 1977, there's Pal Hal, Fat Hal Ballard, sitting right there for the plucking. And he loved being skewered. And it was just indulged. It was encouraged. It was competitive. There were three daily papers in Toronto then, as there are now. And it was, now there are four. But it was fun, and they wanted you to have fun, and they called it the toy department, and you could grow very, very quickly. If you had the potential to be a good writer, to be a good reporter, the sports, as they call the toy department, always at the Globe, afforded you that right. Go have fun. Go to the Argos game and have fun. Who can't have fun if you're at an arena with 40,000 screaming people and guys in two different colored helmets bashing each other on the field, and colorful characters who run the teams and who root for the teams? Got to have fun with that, because it really is the toy department. But if you want to make it your career, go have fun. Flex the language. You don't have to say that Willie Mays hit a home run. You can say Willie Mays belted a gargantuan blast, and off you go. It indulges the descriptive. It indulges the fantastic. And sure, it's a good training ground, because it teaches you to look around. And it also teaches you to write with your inner voice when there are 50,000 screaming people sitting all around you.
Are you working on another book now?
Not if you divide dollars by hours. No, I don't have. If this book were to succeed, which I would never predict, if someone asked me and said, here's a possibility, maybe, but I can't see doing it again. I can't see that. achieved enough as an author to do it again.
I've kept you longer than I said I would, but it's such a pleasure to speak to you because I enjoyed this book, and as you know, enjoyed Flatbush Odyssey a great deal. Congratulations on the short life of Ewan McClune, and good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
The book is called The Short Life of Huey McClune, A True Story of Baseball Magic and Murder. It is published by Sutherland House. Its author, Alan Abel, joined me on the line from Washington, D.C. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.